Broadcasting from our studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the business of Southern sports, or as we like to call it, The Boss. The Boss is presented by Dirty Girl Mixers. Get your mix fix. And by RecTech Grills. Join the RecTech lifestyle. Now, here is the host of The Boss, Roger Maness.
And welcome to the Business of Southern Sports podcast, or as we call it, The Boss. I am Roger Maness, and that was Herschel and the Heismans, our fictional house band, playing us in for our great guest today. It is the radio voice of the Atlanta Braves and an old friend from way back when, Jim Powell. How are you, Jim?
Roger, now that I'm with you, I'm great. It is really good to see you, my friend.
What'd you think of the house band? Fictional, royalty-free music, Herschel and the Heismans.
So is Herschel really in that band? Come on.
No.
But I love the music, though.
Well, it's just, you know, I love Southern sports. The Braves, of course, are my team growing up, but my college football team is Georgia. But I just love college football, so it's kind of a tip of the cap. If you've won a Heisman playing for a Southern school, you're in the band, but Herschel is the leader of the band.
I see. Well, maybe can I be one of the Heismans?
Sure, yeah, if you can go win one. Like I said, so as we record this podcast, this is the Braves' day off after 20 games in. They're 11-9. So let's just talk baseball first. Where do we stand? I mean, besides the obvious,
we're a little short on pitch.
I was going to say, besides the obvious at 11-9, where do we stand?
Well, you know, 11-9 is good considering all the adversity the Braves have had. In fact, Brian Snitker said after the game last night that would you take 11-9 knowing, you know, you've got no Cole Hamels and Mike Foltynewicz is back at the alternate site. So is Sean Newcomb and Mike Soroka's out for the year. And Ronald Acuna and Ozzy Albies are currently sidelined. Would you take 11-9 if you knew all that? And he said, absolutely. So the in the big picture, the team has survived the first third of the season. And that's a plus. They're taking so many teams to the playoffs that you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to finish 50-10 to get in the playoffs. And once you're in the playoffs, you know, it's anybody's got a shot. So the real focus is to just make that playoff field. And at 11-9, the Braves have not shot themselves in the foot so far. But they've got to turn around the situation with the pitching staff. You know, of the first 20 games played in the season, 10 of those had the Braves starting pitcher go four or fewer innings. And that just can't happen. I mean, you can't beat good teams when your starting pitcher is out. And lately it's been more like an inning or an inning and a third or two innings. And you just can't put that kind of burden on what is a very good and deep bullpen, but still even a good and deep bullpen cannot cover that many innings.
What is the status report on Hamels? What do we expect and when?
I think Hamels wishes he wasn't on the injured list. I think he wishes he was out there pitching right now. So I think when his time is up in the beginning of September, I don't know the exact date, but it's 4 or 5 days into September, I think he'll be ready to pitch. And now how effective he is, how good he feels and all that, I don't know. But he's throwing, he's working, he's progressing. And I think eventually, hopefully, he'll be able to help.
Now, injuries, we touched on that, been an issue. Acuna is going to miss this weekend series against the Marlins. Albies has been out. Neither is expected to be long-term, but that takes some punch out of the lineup. But yet this is an offense that seems to score runs in bunches when it's clicking. Can the offense carry the team until the pitching comes around?
That's a good question, Roger. I think it can, especially if Albies and Acuna are able to get back fairly quickly. Riley is showing good signs of life. Camargo is coming on. Markakis has opted back in. Those are really positive things on the offensive side. Adam Duvall is swinging the bat very well. So it's still a very deep lineup, even with Ozzy and with Ronald not playing. So when they come back, I think the offense should score as many runs as any team in the National League. Which is a positive thing. And the bullpen will continue to be strong as long as it's not overtaxed. They just can't throw six innings every day.
Right, yeah. Even in a short season, they can't do that. Let's talk a little bit about everybody's having to react to coronavirus. And, of course, Major League Baseball lost a big chunk of its season, and has gotten out of the gate and playing ball, and some clubs have missed games here and there because of the virus itself. How do you think this whole season is going in adjusting to Corona?
I think it's going pretty well. I mean, I obviously there have been a couple of teams where mistakes were made, and those teams are suffering. But generally speaking, it's been pretty limited. There's still testing players all across the league virtually every day. And we're not seeing other teams, you know, with coronavirus spiking up. We're not seeing big spread in the clubhouses or anything like that. So generally speaking, I think it's going well. That said, as we all know, 5 minutes from now, it might be different. On the other hand, in 10 minutes, maybe those teams that had a little spike will have it under control. They'll finish their quarantines and they'll get back to playing. So I think Major League Baseball, I believe their protocols, based on the testing results, I would say the protocols and precautions that they put in place for the start of the baseball season are working. It's just you can't control a 22-year-old who goes to a strip club at 2 o'clock in the morning because he just decided that he's invulnerable. And that's the kind of thing that I think has caused a couple of teams to suffer. But I think that also was a wake-up call for the rest of the teams in Major League Baseball that, look, guys, there's no fooling around with this. You have to follow. I know literally the Braves have a meeting every single day where they stress to the players, we are in this together. Don't do anything for yourself. Do things for your teammates. Do things for your teammates' families. Do things for the coaching staff's family and the coaches and manager themselves. Think about others before you think about yourself. These are all good lessons that we should all be practicing anyway. So it's actually probably a good education for some of the young players that maybe, depending on their background, maybe they haven't heard as much of that in their lives as they should have.
Well, and it's interesting the way the sport has handled it, because it really can't play in a bubble. Basketball has had great success in the bubble, but yet you're asking everybody just to be exceptionally careful, increase the testing, and with a blip here and there, so far, so good. We're a third of the way through, and it doesn't seem like, although anything could change, that it can be derailed at this point because those precautions seem to be working.
Agreed. And I do believe Major League Baseball is very committed to trying to finish the season. If they have to make adjustments, like I know there's been talk that if the Cardinals don't get over their problem right now, at some point, they'll just be dropped from the whole system. They'll cease operations, and you'll have 29 teams instead of 30. But they're going to make that adjustment and move on. Hopefully, the Cardinals are able to play and remain in the game. But that's the kind of flexibility that Major League Baseball is showing, and that's the kind of flexibility that they have to show in order to have any chance to finish the season.
Speaking of flexibility, this is an interesting thing to me with a media background that fans may not understand or appreciate, but you're no longer traveling with the team. And as a play-by-play guy, typically you're at the ballpark. You're able to walk around the field and the batting cage and develop your relationship with the guys. You travel with the team. But now you're having to call ball games that are on the road from a booth watching a television monitor in Atlanta. Tell me about that adjustment and that experience, how the challenges involved there for you in order to be able to paint a picture of a game that you're not at.
You know, it's really strange. I mean, everything about 2020 is just bizarro world, you know? And so I'm maintaining a very positive outlook. It's gotten better every day as I do more of the road games off a monitor. They make adjustments. They're technically working with us on different camera shots and things of that nature. I've got, when I set up for a road game, I've got my iPad open here. I've got my laptop open right next to that. I've got my monitor right in front of me. I've got a larger monitor with the all nine shot where I can see the defenders and the bases right behind that. I've got a massive TV through the window in the booth next door that's got an even larger all nine. And those are things that they've been adding along the way to try and give us more and more support. On my iPad, I'm using a baseball research tool from MLB that shows they're tracking the players that are on the field, and you can actually glance down and see how the defense is set up by, and even as they are moving around, you know, shifting and then edging away, get two strikes, and the shortstop moves closer to second base than he was in the shift. And so there's just, it's the real key for me, Roger, has been learning how to find what I need immediately without hesitation. So learning how to look at these five or six different screens, and know when I see something that I can't see that, and know where my eyes need to flit in order to find that information as quickly as possible. That has been a process that, again, it's getting better day by day. The first day or two, I got to tell you, I mean, I literally could not sleep the night or two before the first road game I was going to do, because I was just very afraid. I'm a perfectionist by nature, and I knew it wasn't going to be able to be perfect, but I kill myself when I make mistakes or I don't get the information out as quickly as I want to. So once I got through the first couple of road games and they started making some adjustments with our screens, and I started getting used to knowing where to look for what I need without having to think about it, then I went back to sleeping at night. But
yeah, let's make sure you get your sleep.
Yeah, well, that is actually one of the biggest, I say it all the time, the number one key is managing your body clock in this sport, because you're in different time zones and you're traveling in the middle of the night and all that kind of stuff. Well, we're not traveling now. I'm just driving to Truist Park every day and doing a game. And if it's live in the ballpark, because it's a home game, then we do it, you know, somewhat normally. And if we're on the road, it's a different thing, but we figured out how to make it a makeable putt.
It's interesting to me, the road game. I you know, obviously you have the wealth of experience. I would think the most difficult play to call, correct me if I'm wrong, would be the fly ball, because you can't know immediately the trajectory as to is this a easy out, is this a warning track, or is this gone? Because you're having to be monitor reliant. But when it's in front of you, I mean, you can tell that, oh, that he ripped that one.
Right.
So are you just having to be patient with your call to kind of let it unfold visually for you before you can inflect, raise your voice, show the anticipation of it clearing the wall if it's a Braves home run, et cetera?
Yes, and that's why my home run calls have sucked.
I didn't want to say that, but I'd noticed that. So I was.
Thanks, Roger. Johan Camargo did me a great service last night by crushing that ball to down the right field line and then slamming his bat to the ground. I was like, okay, that's now I can rev up a home run call. This is great. But yeah, you kind of I do a lot of in the air to right, because that's all I know. So you kind of relearn some things about calling the game. But it's really back to the basics of only call what you can see, what you know. Don't try and get ahead of the play. It's always dangerous to try and get ahead of the play anyway. So yes, I'm having to go a little slower. And when they give that first shot of the outfielders, are they angling back? Sometimes I think they're going to be angling back, but they're sprinting in because it's off the end of the bat and it didn't travel at all. So yeah, I'm having to be patient, and that's not easy for me. I'm not a patient guy, but, especially when it comes to play by play, but, it is what it is. I have to do what I need to do to get the correct information to our audience. That's for whom I work. I mean, I'm employed by the Atlanta Braves, but I work for the Atlanta Braves fans all across the world. Really, we hear from people all around the world who are Braves fans. And my job is to get them correct, accurate information in as timely a fashion as I possibly can. And I have to understand my limitations therein.
Let's talk about your love of baseball. I've known you for many years, and you loved baseball. You know, I grew up loving baseball, not able to play it very well, but loving all sports. Those of us who got into sports media obviously had a love for the game, but you specifically focused on baseball. That is what I remember about you. Your goal, your dream, was to be a play-by-play guy in the major leagues, and you've been doing that for 20-plus years now, or however long it's been. When did you first fall in love with the game?
You know, it's as far back as I can remember. I mean, I remember I was born in Atlanta, and I remember we lived 10 years real near Piedmont Park. And so I was 10 years old when we moved out to Roswell. I remember when I remember the house that I lived those first 10 years in. And I remember being probably like 5-6 years old, you know, asking my dad, you know, why do they say middle of the seventh? Why isn't it 7.5 innings? Or I remember I'm just trying to assimilate the game in my mind. And I just was always just fascinated with baseball. And I listened to the games on the radio. You know, we're talking in the early 70s, and I listened to every game, and Ernie Johnson and, you know, Skip Carey, Pete Van Wieren, those guys were my idols. And another reason I got the idea of being a baseball broadcaster, I was blessed with two great parents, and they challenged me. They said, you can do anything you want if you set your mind to it. So you just have to think about what do you want to do. So I went through a process as a little kid. You know, okay, wow, that sounds cool. And so you start thinking, well, what can I do? And so I thought about, well, I could be a baseball writer. They were all baseball related, by the way. So it's like, what job in baseball do I want?
Baseball player?
But there's that thing about the curveball.
Yeah.
So my dad did give me the caveat, like, you can be anything you want. I mean, you can't guarantee you're going to be a baseball player, but
within reason.
So, within reason. Yeah. So I started thinking about the various jobs. I thought, well, maybe being a baseball manager would be great. But, you know, the Braves managers would get fired like every other year because they were always terrible in those years. What about a general manager? Well, same deal, changing the general manager all the time. What about the beat writer? I was learning to read by reading the sports page, you know, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. What about a sports writer? And I was like, you know, that seems like every night you watch a game and then you have to write a term paper or, you know, an essay on it. That doesn't sound like fun. That's like punishment. So, but then I kept thinking about Skip and Pete and Ernie and how much fun they always sounded like they were having. They're joking around. They're talking about where they had dinner the night before. And when the game was over, they got to just go away. They did the game. And then, so, you know, my initial goal was, how do I get in free to baseball games? And then that eventually became, how do I get to be a baseball broadcaster? Who those guys do get in free, and they also have a good time. So I was blessed to actually get a feel for what I really wanted to do at an early age, and so I could pursue it early, starting even in high school, and carrying that through college and then on into my professional career. So I basically pursued being a baseball broadcaster since I was probably 10 years old.
Well, and that's fantastic. You talk about setting a goal and achieving it and excelling at it. Were you a kid fascinated by the sport? Well, you know, there are lots of characters playing in the 70s and 80s and things like that, but it's a very statistically important sport. Numbers matter, probably more than any other. It's very data-driven. Also, some kids grow up, just they get attached to the sport because dad played catch in the yard with him, or because they collected baseball cards, things like that. Were any of those kind of in your wheelhouse too, as just sort of an ancillary interest, or did you just kind of gravitate to the whole thing?
No, all of those were in my brain. I'm a math-oriented guy. My father was a genius electrical engineer, worked for Bell Labs and AT&T, and he was like crazy smart. And I also had an affinity for numbers and excelled at math and scored well test-wise in those regards. I actually skipped the fourth grade. I was doing so well academically, which I don't think I've told anybody that in 30 years. Well, only you, Roger.
Now you're just bragging.
Well, yeah, I guess I know I should take that back.
No, fantastic. That's awesome. That's great. I knew you were a smart guy, but that's impressive.
I shouldn't have said that. So, but yeah, so I love the numbers. I collected baseball cards. Absolutely. I played catch with my dad in the front yard. Yes, I did. I loved, the more I got to know baseball, the more I felt like the other sports were exciting too. I mean, I love football. I used to watch basketball a lot. I don't watch it as much anymore. It doesn't seem as challenging for guys who are 7'5" to dunk a basketball. And I always feel like when I'm watching ESPN or one of the highlight shows and there's all they show is dunks, it's like, you're just going to show golfers tapping in a 6-foot putt? I mean, come on.
It's almost unfair, isn't it? Yeah.
I know. But baseball to me was chess. Baseball was chess. And it was also, I still look at it as an onion, that I want everybody to love baseball. And I try and sell baseball to people because I feel like baseball is a gift to anyone who embraces it. Some people are going to follow it very closely And they'll peel back many layers of the onion, and they'll always find that there's another layer they can peel back. Others may only just want to, you know, enjoy baseball because of the ambiance and the pacing, and go to a game and or watch some on TV or listen to it on the radio on the drive home. And they may not peel that many layers of the onion. I want them to love baseball too. But I've peeled back a lot of layers of the onion, and I still peel back layers even as we speak. I learn from other people in the game. I'm blessed to be around a lot of ex-players as well as current players. And they're all, you know, easy to talk to about the sport that they obviously love and their lives are dedicated to. So I feel like I'm, it's like a, what do they call it? A doctor practices medicine. I feel like I'm still practicing baseball broadcasting and baseball as a fan myself, because I still am learning things all the time.
You mentioned guys being so big now, they can just dunk the basketball so easily. But in baseball for 100 years, you still got to hit a curveball. You know, size doesn't matter. And if Greg Maddux paints the corner, it's a strike.
Right.
You know, and he did a lot of that back in the day. Okay, let's go back on your career path a little bit in case somebody wants to, is out there dreaming of being a baseball broadcaster. Out of college, you went to the minors, right? You found a job in you were working radio and just trying to cobble together a living in broadcasting, and you got into minor league play-by-play, correct?
That's correct. I went to Columbia, South Carolina out of college, and I worked at a TV station, but I pretty much realized I wasn't going to be moving up very quickly there because I looked like I was about 5 years old. So that was not going to be a quick path to anything. So I got a job at the flagship station for the University of South Carolina in Columbia, WVOC. And eventually I started doing Columbia Mets games for that station. Eventually I became the sports director of that station, did a lot of stuff with the Gamecocks, college baseball, minor league baseball. I had some great bosses in Columbia that wanted to encourage me in my career and give me flexibility to do some other things. So I began traveling to Charlotte, North Carolina, and doing Charlotte Knights games. I would drive to Atlanta in one stretch for a couple of years, 91, 92, drive to Atlanta, work for WSB on weekends, doing programming around University of Georgia football games and Falcons and Braves. And so I got a really good education for about 10 years while I was in Columbia. And then I got my big break, which was I got hired by the Minnesota Twins to fill in a couple of seasons. So I got some Major League Baseball experience. That was huge. And then eventually I got a full-time baseball play-by-play job working with Bob Uecker in Milwaukee and spent 13 years with him. And my number one achievement in this career is that no partner ever worked with Bob Uecker longer than I did. I was his longest tenured partner, and I'm really, really proud of that.
Wait, even the guy that sat next to him in the major league movies?
Who looks unfortunately way too much like me.
But that wasn't you.
That wasn't me.
What years were you with the Twins? You weren't with the Twins when the Braves series in 91.
No, yeah, I wasn't. And I was still bitter when I worked for the Twins in 93 and 94.
Okay.
So they had a couple of medical issues with their broadcast team. One guy had to miss time in 93, and another guy had to miss time in 94. And the program director of their flagship station had been at WSB and was familiar with me and gave me a week-long tryout along with a couple other guys. And then they hired me for the remainder of the season at the end of my week. And then they brought me back again the following year when the other gentleman had a medical issue. So I got 2 years, and then in 94, that was shortened by the strike, which was devastating to me because I had no guarantee of any job anywhere. And I thought I very well might be working my last major league game. Fortunately, it didn't turn out that way.
One question I wanted to ask you about Columbia, anybody come through that minor league system that ended up being a household name, you know, a Hall of Famer years later, or it's just interesting. Some of these all-stars and Hall of Famers, they started in single A, double A. Anybody crossed your path there in Columbia?
Well, you know, the Braves had an affiliate in Sumter. So I would see some of the Braves guys as they were coming up and as they were building their juggernaut farm system. So I saw some good players there. The Columbia Mets at that time were obviously a Mets affiliate. I would say Fernando Vina was probably the best player that came through there. We didn't have we had a lot of promising players, but we didn't have a lot of guys who went on to be superstars.
Yeah, there are so many guys that play in the minors that want it so badly, and only a select few get to the show, as they say, to use the cliche. And on the broadcasting, that is the same thing. There's plenty of guys out there toiling every day, calling games. You were one of them, and you got your shot at the bigs. You took advantage of it, and talent rose to the top. So let's now go to Milwaukee. Bob Uecker sitting by you. You're very proud of the fact that you were his longest tenured partner. Give me some Bob Uecker stories, man. Clean ones.
Well, I got to think about, we have this sort of agreement amongst our booth.
Sure,
we don't let a lot out.
Let the publicly available out.
Yeah. I can just tell you that he's the funniest, most genius comic I think that ever lived. I mean, he's way funnier than you think he is. If you think he's funny, you don't know anything yet. He loves to make people laugh. It doesn't matter if he's on the air. It doesn't matter if he's emceeing a banquet. It doesn't matter if he's just riding on a bus on the way to the ballpark. One story I can tell is that we would usually the bus ride over at 3:30 in the afternoon for a 7 o'clock game. There are only three or four people on the bus. It's me, the producer engineer, Kent Sommerfeld, Bob Uecker, traveling secretary, Dan Larea. That's about it. Maybe the TV guys, Brian Anderson, was on there, Bill Schroeder. So you'd have just a handful of people on the bus. Didn't matter how small the audience was or how well they knew Bob. He would just start entertaining. He just so funny. It's just like he's not happy if he's not making people laugh. So when we were in Montreal, we would be driving on the bus ride, and Bob would be seeing these billboards that are in French, and he would start doing a put on voice like he was a French Canadian sports journalist, and he'd pluck a word here and a word there off a billboard and put it into his vernacular, and then he'd say, also known as you suck, or stuff like that, just silly stuff that would just make us all laugh. Well, one year when we went there, we got to the ballpark, and I proposed to Bob, let me interview you for the pregame show. I had to do an interview every day. So for the pregame show, let me interview you, but you in character as this French Canadian guy that you've been, who was nameless at that point, who you've been like building, you've been developing this character now for every year we've been going to Montreal. So, and he was not inclined to do it. And I said, well, we'll do it. It doesn't have to be for air. We'll just do it just for fun. And then, we'll just do it for fun. So he agreed to do that. So thus was born Jean-Jacques Smythe. And I interviewed Jean-Jacques Smythe. And he was absolutely hysterical. He was doing the same thing that he did on the bus. He was plucky. He was looking at like advertisement boards inside the stadium in Montreal. And he was plucking a word here and a plucking a word there. And he was insulting himself, this Bob Uecker. So like, he's insulting himself. He's insulting me. He's insulting Bud Selig. And he just was absolutely hilarious. And when it was all done, then I talked him into letting it air. So we put it on the pregame show without telling anybody anything. And so Jean-Jacques Smythe is interviewed on the pregame show, this renowned French-Canadian journalist, Jean-Jacques Smythe. And this interview airs. Well, when Jean-Jacques Smythe begins insulting Bud Selig and insulting Bob Uecker and insulting me, the phones light up back at WTMJ in Milwaukee. People are, why is this guy on the air? What is he? They're incensed. They have no idea that I'm interviewing Bob Uecker. And they never did. We ended up interviewing him, having him on the pregame show every time after that we went to Montreal. We did another Jean-Jacques Smythe interview. And every time the phones lit up, and nobody ever had any idea it was actually just Bob Uecker.
Is this stuff available on YouTube now? If not, please post it.
I do have copies of one or two of the shows somewhere in my digital files. But
I would love to hear Jean-Jacques Smythe. What's interesting is for as a fan of Uecker, I'm sitting here thinking, no, I don't know him. I've never met him. But the fact that the movie Major League is, you know, remembered in guy circles forever, and it's just a cliche now because of the way he said, just a bit outside. You know, everybody uses that. And then the old Miller Lite commercials where he, you know, he was a star of the Miller Lite commercials, and, right, and his, oh, I must be in the front row, you know, where the usher is making him move, and just the delivery. You mentioned his comedic skill set, but his delivery and inflection was, it's just so memorable.
Well, I mean, he used to crush Johnny Carson. He was the only guy that could make Johnny lose his crap, and Bob would be cool as a cucumber. Another story about Bob is that his day wasn't complete unless he got me to laugh uncontrollably on the air and make a fool of myself. So he was constantly, and he didn't always succeed. I'm not a real easy mark, but he could do things. He'd like set the hook early in the day, little ditties that he'd come up with that, James Mouton was a sort of pedestrian major league outfielder. And he one day started talking just like, usually it was born on a bus ride or in the press room or whatever. And he started talking about Jimmy Moo. And then that's what he called him. And then he started rhyming Jimmy Moo with anything that he could. And then we got in the broadcast that night and he started doing some of that. And then I got in the post game show and he started, every time I'd say the word two, okay, I'm doing the post game scoreboard. So the Astros, you know, beat the Reds today 5-2, and he's in the back of the booth because he hasn't left yet because he doesn't want to. He's going to get me. He already knows I'm laughing at all his Jimmy Moo silliness. And so, I'd say Astros win it 5-2, and he drops in Jimmy Moo or whatever in the background. And he finally got me laughing so much. There was probably like close to 5 minutes where I could not speak on the air. And he would not leave. Every time I'd start to get my act together again, he'd drop something else in. And it was just, that's Bob Uecker in a nutshell. He's just having fun. It literally, the first game I ever worked with him, a spring training game in 96, he said, don't worry about anything. We're just here to have a good time. Just have fun. That's what we're here for. And that sounded like, okay, he's just patting me on the head and telling me everything's going to be fine. But that really is the way he goes through life, is looking to have fun each and every day and make sure the people around him are also having fun.
Well, and that's full circle from your childhood dreams, watching either listening on the radio or when Ted Turner put the Braves on what became the Superstation, and seeing Pete and Skip and Ernie and, you know, laughing, especially when the baseball might be bad and the announcers find themselves having to entertain themselves and the audience.
Right.
That it really became full circle for you, that Uecker made it fun, but that's what you wanted anyway. You wanted it to
exactly.
be fun.
Yes. I mean, I am totally a product of Skip and Pete and Ernie and the lopsided bad games where they'd start doing puns and, you know, making each other laugh and lose their crap on the air. Yeah. And I thought that was just great. And then I, you know, I've also been greatly influenced by Larry Munson. I didn't actually grow up a Georgia fan. Both my parents went to Georgia Tech. And I was an Al Seraldo listener and followed, you know, Eddie Lee Ivory and the Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets, even though they generally weren't very good and Georgia was better. And my buddies were all Georgia fans, so we all had that rivalry. But then I needed to go to Georgia for broadcasting reasons because Tech doesn't really have a broadcasting program and Georgia has an excellent one. But even back in the days when I was just a kid loving Tech, I would listen to Larry Munson because there's nobody who's ever done a college football game like Larry Munson. And he was partisan, but that was okay because his audience was partisan too. And he never lied to the audience. He didn't boast about the Dogs. In fact, it was the other way around.
Yeah, he was very pessimistic.
Very pessimistic. And like, so if Georgia won, my gosh, what a miracle it was. And they just beat the little sisters of the poor, you know? But so I have taken a lot from that I, with the Braves Radio Network, I know my audience is not a national audience. People may listen to the Braves broadcast and I'm sure do that aren't necessarily Braves fans for a variety of reasons, but I don't work for them. I work for the Braves fans. So I, like Larry Munson, I think learning from Larry Munson, I understand who my audience is and what they're looking for. They're not looking to be lied to, misled, boast about the team beyond what's true. They're looking for fair, honest descriptions of what's happening in the game. I wish I was half as good at Larry at conjuring up some of that stuff. Look, those thighs! You know, the way he could roar with a call. And you know, I'm not in Larry Munson's league, but I learned a lot from him. So I kind of a combination of listening to the Braves guys, who also were not ashamed to let you know that they were there hoping the Braves would win that day, but without giving you inaccurate commentary. And then Larry, who could paint a picture like nobody else, even though he wasn't my favorite broadcaster until I got to UGA and got converted to Georgia football.
Well, and that's, we grew up back in the days where not every game was televised. So the radio play-by-play people became personalities of huge importance in our lives. Larry being one of them. And then, as I mentioned, Ted Turner eventually bought the Braves, put them on the Superstation. So it, you know, you could watch every game, but it was still the same guys rotating between radio and TV. I remember the Braves being so bad. I mean, I loved Hank Aaron and Dale Murphy and Phil Niekro, and they would do Braves caravans through my hometown of Rome, and I would go get autographs and all of that. But I just remember, you know, sometimes they were so bad, I would root for a rain delay so I could watch an episode of the Andy Griffith Show, you know, which they would throw up during a rain delay. I mean, I love baseball, but, oh, okay, great. They're good. There's the tarp's still out. We could watch another Andy.
That's right. Well, that's why those managers kept getting fired every other year. So, and I decided not to be a manager.
Well, that worked out well. So how difficult a choice was it, a life choice, et cetera, to leave Milwaukee, because you had been there so long and had great working relationships? But was it just Atlanta was home and a childhood dream when that job opened up?
Well, it was certainly, to work for the Braves was beyond anything I actually did dream about, because there are only 30 teams. The odds that you even get any major league job, even a part-time major league job, are tiny. So I never really spent a lot of time dreaming of getting back to Atlanta and being a Braves announcer. Plus, I wanted Skip and Pete to continue to work forever. I knew, you know, Ernie was got a little older and retired, but when the Braves booth became wide open because Skip had passed away and then Pete retired unexpectedly in the off season, I was like, this is crazy. You know, the entire Braves booth is open. And I felt like I had never applied for another job. I was 13 years in Milwaukee. I had never applied for another job, never thought about applying for another job. Didn't want to go anywhere else. I wanted to work with Euchre forever. And that was my goal. I actually, one of my first calls was when I heard about Pete retiring, was to Bob. And Bob said, you're absolutely crazy if you don't go for this job. You have to. Obviously, Bob has an Atlanta background as well, having been a former Braves player. And they kind of gave him his start on the speaking tour and all that after his playing days. So I think he made the first call. I think he called the Braves before I did. And recommended me. And, you know, we went through the process, and I wasn't sure it was going to come to fruition, because I had, you know, we loved where we lived. We loved Milwaukee. After we settled into Milwaukee, I actually felt like, you know, maybe I was really a Midwesterner at heart all along. Because we just love the people there. That, you know, the weather is so difficult in Milwaukee that the weak or those who aren't committed move. Those who stay love their community. So there's a, you know, Atlanta's a very transient city, as we all know. People move in, people move out. You have neighbors you love, and then 5 minutes later they're gone. And they got new neighbors, and Milwaukee wasn't like that. People have put down their roots and they love their community. And as a part of that, they, you know, they invested in their community, maybe more so than we do here in Atlanta. I don't know, but I just knew that I was very impressed with the people of Milwaukee and the schools and our kids. We had three kids. One was born in South Carolina, and then we immediately moved to Milwaukee. The other two were born in Milwaukee, and we were content to stay there. We built a house, and we were content to stay there forever. But, you know, to pass up the opportunity to come work for the Atlanta Braves, to pass up the opportunity to come back to Atlanta, where my wife Emmy's parents were still alive, but they were getting old enough where they were having difficulty traveling to Milwaukee. Otherwise, they didn't want to come up there when it's that cold.
Right.
But so we had, by coming back to Atlanta, my kids got to know another generation that they otherwise wouldn't know. And I think that's given them context and perspective that has aided them greatly already and will carry with them the rest of their lives. So it was worth it on every front. And we're blessed that we were able to come here.
And what year was that? How long have you been doing the Braves?
So it was my 13th year, I think it was, like 09.
Wow, we're getting old, Jim.
I know.
I was going to say, you touched on your family there. I've known you since college. You married your college sweetheart, Emmy.
Yes.
Been married forever. Three kids, three girls. Is that right?
Three girls, yes.
All I think, two Georgia Bulldogs and one Florida State Seminole. Is that correct?
Yeah, the middle child's got to be a rebel. So she went to Florida State. She actually now works for the governor of Florida. She works in the governor's office.
But she made you pay out-of-state tuition, so...
She got a pretty much a full academic ride.
Actually. Oh, well, good for her.
Well, we told her if you're going to go to college just in a different state, just so you can say you passed the state line, then you can pay for it. So she figured out how to qualify for academic scholarship so she could thumb her nose at her old man.
So since she got back in your good graces.
Yes.
Well, I appreciate your time, Jim. I didn't mean to keep you that long. Just great catching up with you, known you and Emmy forever. And we talked on the phone last week and was happy to set up this podcast. So let's just wrap it up talking about the Braves. 40 games to go plus the playoffs. Can this team win the whole thing? And will it be a legitimate world title when they do because of this shortened season?
You know, good questions. You know, if Cole Hamels comes back and is something like Cole Hamels, that will be greatly improve the odds that the Braves can run the gamut. Max Fried is legit. If he stays healthy, then he's at least a legit front of the rotation guy. Going to need at least one of the Sean Newcomb, Mike Foltynewicz type guys, Ian Anderson maybe down the road, to come through. It's going to be really difficult to make trades because going to be out of it. The playoff field is going to be so large that very few teams are going to be like, oh, okay, we're going to give up. And so you can have one of our starting pitchers, but the price you'd have to pay for a starting pitcher on a team would be such that, well, what if we pay this price and with three prospects and then 5 minutes later, COVID shuts down Major League Baseball. And then so you almost can't trade for somebody unless they've got multiple years on their contract, which is going to make the cost even higher to acquire that. So really, most of the problems the Braves and all other teams have are going to have to be solved at their alternate site. I don't know why they call it the alternate site. I would think they could come up with something more clever than that. But there's, you know, in this case, Gwinnett. You know, they've got 30 players working at Gwinnett, and they've got, you know, hopefully some guys who can help down the road. I mean, as when Sean Newcomb was sent down to the alternate site, Brian Snitker said, you know, we're sending him down there to pitch, keep working and fix himself because we're going to have him before this is all said and done. And that's really the way the Braves are looking at it. Pretty good chance the Braves are going to be in the playoffs. Hard to imagine that the Braves, even as currently constructed with the obvious pitching deficiencies they're suffering from at the moment, hard to imagine the Braves don't make the playoff field. Once they get in there, they've got a great lineup. And hopefully they'll have enough pitching where they can navigate through. And will it be legitimate? To be honest with you, Roger, any team that wins this year, I mean, they will have cleared so many hurdles that no team has ever had to clear that I mean, I guess everybody will look at it the way they want to look at it. I will look at it as maybe even a more legitimate champion because they're having to win against COVID and they're having to win against their own instincts. They come out of quarantine and go to restaurants and mix in crowds and date a girl and, you know, whatever, all the things that we're all having to deal with. The players have to do. I mean, today's an off day, Roger. They're at Key Biscayne, Florida, and they can't leave their hotel rooms. It's the first off day they've had in 3 weeks, and they're not allowed to leave their hotel rooms. And if they do, I mean, you can't, there's only so much you can do to trap a 25-year-old able-bodied athlete. If they do leave, they may well bring COVID back to the hotel or the bus or the airplane and ruin the entire season for all of the Atlanta Braves and their broadcasters, by the way.
Right.
So what these people are up against in 2020, if whoever ends up standing at the end I will look at them as super legit, not with an asterisk or a question mark. I will say I will tip my cap like no other time.
I would agree with that simply because everybody's playing by the same rules. The rules have changed, but everybody's playing under the same rules. And if you win it, you win it. It's X number of games this year. So be it. You know, that's what it is. So anyway, I could talk all day with you, but I need to let you go and wrap up the podcast. Would you like to throw to Herschel and the Heismans to wrap up the Boss podcast here, Jim, the business of Southern sports? Our guest has been Jim Powell, the radio voice of the Atlanta Braves. Take it away, Jim.
It is my pleasure to be with you, Roger. I had a great time talking with you. I'll be talking with you again soon, I'm sure. And without further ado, here are Herschel and the Heismans.
Way to sell it, Jim. Woo!
The Boss has been brought to you by Dirty Girl Mixers. Get your mix fix. And by RecTech Grills. Join the RecTech lifestyle. The Boss podcast is a copyrighted presentation of Big Dog Productions Incorporated. You can find us online at bigdogproductions.tv. For more episodes of The Boss, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or log on to thebosspodcast.net.